This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening, Africa. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington, filling in for Yahias Wahib. And here's what's coming up.
It's harmful to the transition because it inhibits Parliament from being able to pass the really difficult economic reforms that it needs in order to move the transition forward. When you're constantly worried about staying in power and the government is constantly turning over, it's hard to tackle any of the sort of longer term, more strategic issues that the government really needs to tackle to really consolidate the democratic transition.
That's Sarah Yerkes, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment's Middle East program on the impact of Tunisia's political turmoil. Also ahead, a new COVID-19 lockdown in Zimbabwe, plus Ugandan singer and politician Bobby Wine forms a new political party, and a look at gold mining in Nigeria. Those stories and more are next on Africa News Tonight. Our top story tonight, Zimbabwe has rolled back the reopening from its COVID-19 lockdown, imposing a 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. curfew and allowing only essential services. Zimbabwe's president announced the tighter COVID-19 regulations after a spike in infections, but critics also say the government's goal with the lockdown is to control dissent as much as it is to control the outbreak. Reporter Kudzai Zvinovace has more.
In a speech to the nation last night, President Emmerson Mnangagwa said he was rolling back the effort to ease the country's lockdown by setting a daily 12-hour curfew and limits on who can leave their homes.
Our country, as of this morning, had recorded 1,713 cases, up from 985 cases recorded by last week. This means the number of positive cases increased by over 600 in just 1 week. During the same period, the number of deaths rose from 18 to 26.
He says it's also worrying that the coronavirus is spreading to workplaces and local communities.
All non-working sections of our population will be required to stay at home, except for purposes of securing food, water, and health services. All business premises must operate from 8 o'clock in the morning until 3 o'clock in the afternoon, with the exception of providers of essential services.
He says security forces will enforce the dusk to dawn curfew with an exception for essential service providers. Intercity travel remains banned, as do church services and other gatherings. It also is now punishable to knowingly aid, abet, or infect someone. This comes after an increasing number of returning citizens who have been fleeing quarantine centers. But there also were questions about government concern over planned nationwide protest July 31st against the president and government. Rashid Mukundu is a political analyst.
It is clear that the new COVID restrictions that the president announced yesterday have absolutely nothing to do with mitigating the COVID-19 pandemic, but everything to do with the politics of this country. If you read closely on the statements that he made, there's nothing that speaks to how the government is going to increase the testing in order to help and mitigate the high rise in infections.
The government has been battered by an economic crisis, devaluation of the local currency, droughts, water shortages, and other problems. In addition, nurses are on strike, the Minister of Health was recently sacked, and public hospital CEOs were relieved and haven't been replaced, complicating the fight against COVID. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zvinovace from Harare.
Bobby Wine, the popular musician and legislator who heads Uganda's People Power movement, announced today the formation of a political party ahead of the 2021 general elections in Uganda. Named the National Unity Platform, with an umbrella as its symbol, the party has been recognized by Uganda's Electoral Commission. Wine is the party's president and plans to run against longtime Ugandan ruler Yoweri Museveni. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Our power, people power. Our power, people power. Our power.
For 3 years, Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, who goes by the name Bobby Wine, has been running his political affairs and pursuit for Uganda's presidency under the People Power Pressure Group. However, as Uganda gears up for the elections, it was becoming increasingly difficult for the pressure group to compete favorably under Uganda's multi-party democracy system amid incessant calls for registration as a political party. Wine says that's now been resolved.
We have received more than 10,000 comrades expressing their desire to run under our platform. As expected, all our people would want a uniform symbol. So having realized that the People Power Movement would never be registered as a political party under the Museveni regime, it became very urgent for us to find a solution. I stand here today to announce to the nation that we are unveiling the National Unity Platform.
Bobby Wine says the new party is the political wing of the People Power Movement that will usher affiliates into the election.
Throughout history, liberation struggleists have often found themselves having to run their course with the political wing or military wing. We are non-violent. We have no plans of establishing a military wing. Our military wing is the People Power Movement, and our weapons are our words and our ideas.
The new party merges the People Power Pressure Group with the 16-year-old National Unity Reconciliation and Development Party, which was formed ahead of the 2011 general elections. Moses Chivalama Nkonge was the president of the party, but confirms that he has legally handed it over to Bobby Wine.
We had a delegates conference at which Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu and other comrades were elected as the new leaders of the National Unity Platform. All formalities were sorted and ironed out. We signed all the necessary legal documents, and all the requirements with the Electoral Commission were registered. So Mr. Kyagulanyi here is the new president of National Unity Platform.
Wine says his legal team tried 2 years ago to reserve the name People Power in case they needed to formally register, but found it had been reserved and flagged. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Ethiopia says its first year target has been reached for filling the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam on the Blue Nile River. The announcement from Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's office indicated enough water had accumulated to enable testing of the dam's first two turbines, an important milestone towards becoming the largest hydroelectric power plant in Africa. The mega dam has stoked tensions with downstream neighbors Egypt and Sudan. They view the dam as a threat to vital water supplies, while Ethiopia considers it essential for energy production. African leaders held a virtual meeting yesterday to try to resolve the dispute. Abiy said it had been fruitful and that there was a, quote, common understanding reached on continuing technical discussions on filling, end quote. Egypt and Sudan said an agreement was reached to continue negotiations with an eye toward a comprehensive deal. Political instability deepens in Tunisia as Prime Minister Elias Fekfek stepped down weeks after being implicated in a conflict of interest case involving his business activities. He also dismissed all six ministers from the leading Islamist party Ennahda after the party withdrew its support for him. Parliamentary elections last October yielded a deeply fractured legislature with no party garnering more than 20% of the vote. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy discussed the reasons behind Tunisia's latest political turmoil with Sarah Yerkes, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment's Middle East program.
The political instability is due to a variety of factors. First of all, I think it's important to remember that Fakhfakh's government really exhibited instability from the beginning. He was the second attempt at forming a government after the elections in October, the first time the parliament was unable to agree. So when he came in, there was a lot of speculation in Tunisia that Fakhfakh's government would actually not last that long. But his undoing was really this corruption scandal. And it's important to note that President Saied was elected really on a platform of uprooting corruption in Tunisia. So it was really impossible for Saied to continue to support Fakhfakh after these allegations came out. But the other piece of this is this divide between Ennahda and the opposition. And particularly in the Speaker of Parliament, Rashid Ghannouchi's the view that many of people that he is overstepping his powers. We've seen him taking a particular role within foreign policy, which is meant to be the purview of the presidency, not within the parliament, and that's made some people upset. And this really ugly fight between Ennahda and the opposition, particularly Abir Moussi and her party, who's close to the old regime, is staunchly secularist, and her party and Ennahda in particular have really just been at odds with each other from the start, which has led to some of the additional instability and polarization within the government.
The October elections in Tunisia yielded a deeply fractured parliament with no party garnering more than 20% of the vote. How serious is the fractured parliament to Tunisian transition to democracy?
I think this is very serious, and it's not the first time we've seen this happen. You know, we're about 10 years into the transition, and Tunisia has had more than 10 governments. So there's been a pattern of this fracturing of the government, but this time it's even worse. No party within the parliament even has a quarter of the seats. And so you've seen these kind of very tenuous coalitions that have had to be formed in order to keep the government in power. Now the government has fallen. There's going to be another attempt at forming the government, and likely we'll see the continued fracturing. Additionally, these sort of tenuous coalitions come into play. And it's harmful to the transition because it inhibits parliament from being able to pass the really difficult economic reforms that it needs in order to move the transition forward. When you're constantly worried about staying in power and the government is constantly turning over, it's hard to tackle any of the sort of longer term, more strategic issues that the government really needs to tackle to really consolidate the democratic transition.
The prime minister's resignation throws the country into political uncertainty at a time of mounting economic challenges, as you said, coronavirus fears, social unrest, and potential spillover from the Libya conflict. The pandemic will likely push unemployment up from its pre-corona level of 15% to above 20%, while the economy is expected to contract by about 7% this year. What is needed, practically speaking, to confront the worsening economic situation in Tunisia?
Well, you're absolutely right that the pandemic has shed really sort of difficult light on the economic situation, has thrown the country into a much further economic turmoil. And I think one of the things that really needs to be done is to address the issue of regional marginalization. What we saw during the pandemic and continue to see is the tremendous disparity between the regions in the interior and the south versus the coast. You know, for example, more than half of the governorates in Tunisia do not have ICU beds. And so what needs to happen is there needs to be more funding specifically funneled towards these regions that have been traditionally marginalized. Luckily, we have seen the international community step up in its efforts to aid Tunisia as it's faced some of this economic crisis through IMF loans and through funding from the international community, such as the United States and Europe. We need to see more of that. We need to see that continue. But at the same time, there needs to be a real effort within the Tunisian government itself to address these long-standing strategic economic issues, including youth unemployment and regional marginalization. Doesn't matter how much money is thrown at Tunisia, this is something that the government itself needs to make a plan and figure out how it's actually going to address this through difficult decisions such as scaling back public sector spending, figuring out a way to actually invest in education in the interior regions. This is something that's going to be very difficult given the political instability that we've been talking about.
That was Sarah Yerkes, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment's Middle East program, speaking to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy. As the COVID-19 pandemic hits Nigeria's economy, Many say they are suffering from rising food prices. Gift Agariga in Abuja tells us more.
As the nationwide lockdown gradually eases, Nigerians worry about significant increases in food prices. Farmers and traders have blamed the hikes to COVID-19, high transportation costs, and scarcity of some essential food items. Yunus Halilu, the Abuja chairman of All Farmers Association Nigeria, said the Boko Haram crisis in the northern part of the country also contributed to the increase.
People are not safe. Farmers who were producing food, most of them cannot go to their farm because of insecurity. So all those things still boil down to all this inflation.
Halilu encouraged more investment in agriculture to boost production.
The way forward is actually for the private sector to come into agribusiness. The production capacity is very low. Storage capacity is not there. Production capacity is very low. Private sectors has to come in.
Nigerians' inflation rate rose 12.56% in June compared with a month earlier, according to the latest Consumer Price Index report released by the Nigeria Bureau of Statistics. Major markets across Abuja have been hit with low patronage as traders complained of low sales due to alternate opening of the markets.
Something that I buy is cheap before, now it's a double money, I need to buy it. I buy almost 8,000 naira per bag. Now they say that it's 5,000.
The buy Nigeria is 21,000 and before now 13,000.
Market is not moving because of coronavirus. People no come to buy.
A resident of Abuja, Miriam John, lamented on how the hike in food prices has affected her.
Ogun leaf that, 200 naira is enough to make soup for me. Now I buy 1,000 naira and it's still not enough. So things have really gone bad and the salary has not increased. It's the same thing.
She called on government to intervene to save Nigerians from high food prices. For VOA News, this is Gift Agiriga from Abuja, Nigeria.
Nigeria's government is aiming to improve gold mining operations to bolster revenue, create new jobs, and diversify the oil-dependent nation's economy. Mike Mbonier reports from Lagos.
President Muhammadu Buhari says improved gold mining operations will create more than 250,000 jobs and over $500 million in royalties and taxes annually. Buhari told the launch of the Presidential Artisanal Gold Mining Initiative that the effort will result in the setup of accredited gold buying centers across key mining areas. He says artisanal miners and small and medium enterprises engaged in mining will also benefit. Analysts say the operations will assist diversify the country's revenue base and improve foreign reserves because the central bank will increase its gold reserves. Some economists say the initiative could bear fruit. Professor K. Onuchukwu is an economist and director of University of Port Harcourt Business School.
For an economy to grow and grow in real terms, there must be what to call product diversification, revenue diversification, and export diversification. You know that the Nigerian economy is a monocultural one where we depend on one product, we depend on one export, and one source of revenue. So if we're able to exploit the gold industry and do adequate legislation and ensure that production is carried out without problem and we'll have enough to export, definitely it's going to boost our foreign reserve.
The government says it lost $3 billion to illegal miners in 6 years. Onuchukwu suggests government should regulate their activities by making them partial owners of some companies operating in the mines.
The activities of the illegal gold miners will have to be regulated by adequate legislation because you don't just leave an industry like that for people to go in and do whatever thing they like. So they that are doing it, government have to look at what they are doing because it's their own source of livelihood and then see how they can improve on what they are doing and also make them partial owners of some of the companies operating in the gold industry to help them survive and also increase their welfare.
Onuchukwu says diversifying the economy will make it more resilient and more capable to withstand any shocks. This is Mike Mbonye for VOA News in Lagos.
South Africa anti-apartheid figure Andrew Mlangeni, who stood aside Nelson Mandela in the historic 1963-64 Rivonia trial, has died at age 95. South Africa's presidency announced his death. Mlangeni was the last surviving Rivonia defendant. He spent more than 25 years imprisoned on Cape Town's notorious Robben Island before his release in 1989. Born in the Johannesburg township of Soweto, he joins the youth wing of the African National Congress in the early 1950s. A decade later, he was among the first groups of liberation fighters to be sent outside of South Africa for military training. When he returned 2 years later, he was arrested along with other ANC leaders. The 8-month Rivonia trial brought the struggle against apartheid to world attention. Mlangeni, Mandela, and other anti-apartheid leaders were sentenced to life imprisonment. COVID-19 can cause anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and other mental illnesses, even among those not infected with the virus. However, in some places, mental illness is stigmatized and its treatments, from medicine to therapy, are badly under-resourced. Wrapping up our two-part series on COVID-19's impact on mental health, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Yuval Nyerere, a professor at the Columbia University Medical Center who directs a post-traumatic stress program and conducted research on epidemics and mental health during the 2016 Ebola outbreak. He explains why mental health professionals are urgently needed during the COVID-19 pandemic.
In the context of a virus like the coronavirus, you need somebody who will know about trauma, about fear, and for family members who unfortunately lost someone, you need an expert in bereavement and how to help people go through bereavement in a good way, in an effective way.
What do mental health professionals actually do during their sessions? What's their goal?
What mental health experts are doing, they are establishing contact with people who is struggling to talk through the experience. Instead of bury the experience inside because of shame or guilt or sense of failure, and yet the people are feeling that they are not alone.
Many people do feel very alone these days, what with quarantining and social distancing and masks.
Absolutely. You know, human beings are social creatures, but COVID really separated us from our families, from our loved ones. Luckily, some of us have the internet, but you cannot touch your children via the internet. You cannot hug them. They cannot do that to you. But I would say in general that keeping the social network active in times of stress and trauma and death is so important. You know, not letting people feel deserted and abandoned. So maintain social relationships, either by phone or video or physically. We must do that.
But as a mental health expert, you found that online counseling during COVID has really been helping.
We at Columbia University Medical Center, we are coming out now with a number of solutions, and it's going pretty well. We didn't stop treatment for people who need us. We actually transitioned from face-to-face meetings, and that's worked pretty well for us.
And as you discovered during your recent trip to Kenya, more and more people on the continent are online via their smartphones. That's good for medical help as well as mental health counseling too.
Exactly. This is so important because if we can transmit medical information about pandemic, we can also address depression and anxiety, which is always the case when you have a crisis. The first period is really about high adrenaline and how to survive. But the second and the third stages are always about grief and mental health problems that are rarely addressed. And a crisis like this provides both tangible losses. You can lose a family member, your salary, but also intangible losses. That is really about, you know, who you are as a person who loves music, loves to go out, loves to go to baseball or basketball. Something that is extreme grief about our identity kind of changing rapidly because of such a massive crisis.
The U.S. military confirmed today that it carried out an airstrike in Somalia targeting pro-Islamic State militants a day after VOA's Somali service first reported the attack. The U.S. statement claims that 7 militants and no civilians were killed. It said the strike was in response to an attack by the militants on partner forces of the U.S. in Somalia. But local officials and witnesses told VOA's Somali service that Puntland regional forces had conducted a ground operation against the militants about 140 kilometers southeast of the port city Bosaso. Officials in Puntland said they killed 20 Islamic State militants during the 48-hour operation, including one senior foreign fighter. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Jason Tinkin in Washington. For all latest developments on the continents 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mukbil Yabaro, and our entire production team, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening and choosing the Voice of America. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.